Chapter 12. At the corner of the alley, Kungus made a little motion with his hand. The Kushan soldiers following him immediately halted. Kungus edged to the corner and peeked out onto the main street. He wasn't worried about being spotted. At night, the streets of Kaushambi were lit by lanterns, but the Malwa were stingy in their placement. As great as was the dynasty's wealth, it was not unlimited, and the massive armament campaign forced a stretching of funds elsewhere. The elite themselves didn't worry about stumbling in the dark. They were born everywhere on slave-toted palanquins, after all. And if the slaves should stumble and discomfort their masters, what did it matter? After the slaves were impaled, new ones would replace them. Unlike street lanterns, slaves were cheap. Satisfied, he turned away. The 10 Kushans following him clustered closely so that they could hear his whispered words. Two doors. The main door, almost directly across, is guarded by 3 Mahaveda. 50 feet farther down is another door. 2 Yetai. That'll be the guardhouse, whispered one of the Kushans. A full squad of Yetai inside. Kungus nodded. Bring the Empress. Another of the soldiers glided back down the alley. A minute later, he returned with Shakuntala and her Maratha women in tow. Watching them approach, Kungus managed not to smile, though he found it a struggle. Some of his soldiers failed completely. 2 of them were grinning outright. Fortunately, they had enough sense to turn their faces away. Never in India's history, he thought wryly, had an empress looked like this. Any trace of imperial regalia was gone, as if it had never existed. Shakuntala and her ladies were now costumed in the traditional garb of North Indian prostitutes. Their saris were not unusual, but the bright orange scarves which wrapped their waists were never worn by respectable women. And while poor women customarily walked barefoot, none but prostitutes wore those large, garish bangles attached to their ankles. The bangles and scarves had been provided by Ahilyabai. The Maratha woman, it turned out, had kept them secreted away in her traveling pack. She had hoped never to use them again, but who could know what life might bring? She and the other Maratha women had shown Shakuntala how to wear them. Quickly, Kungus sketched the situation for the Empress. Shakuntala nodded. We will wait then for the signal, if it comes. She glanced around, frowning. But what will we do if someone spots us in the meantime? We may be here for some time. We are still not sure if this escape will be necessary. Kungus did smile now, very slightly.
That's no problem at all, Your Majesty. In the darkness, it will simply look like a squad of soldiers entertaining themselves in an alley. No one will think to investigate, not even Yetai. Soldiers get surly when they are interrupted in their sport.
Shakuntala grimaced. I'm getting awfully tired of that particular disguise, she muttered. But in truth, there was no ill humor in the remark. Watching her, Kungus thought the Empress was almost hoping the escape attempt would be necessary. She was as high-spirited as a racing horse, and whatever else, a desperate escape would at least bring relief from the endless weeks of immobility. He turned away, partly to keep a watchful eye on the mouth of the alley. Mostly, however, he turned away because even Kungus could not suppress a grin now. Being the bodyguard to this Empress is going to be interesting, like being a bodyguard for the monsoon. In his own alley, a half mile to the northwest, Usanas was also finding it hard not to grin. The Yetai guarding the great Lady Holly's barge were, as usual, paying no attention to their duty. All 4 of them were engrossed in a quiet game of chance, rolling finger bones across the wood planks of the wharf. The bones themselves made little noise beyond a clattering rattle, but the Yetai grunts and hisses of triumph and dismay were audible for 30 yards. Usanas glanced up at the barge. 2 Malwa stood guard at the head of the ramp, which provided access to the barge. The Malwa guards, unlike the Yetai on the wharf below them, were lightly armored and bore only short swords, but the grenades suspended from their belts indicated their Kshatriya status. The Kshatriyas were leaning against the rail of the barge, glaring down at the Yetai. Again, Usanas fought down a grin. Like anyone who chooses to keep a wild animal for a pet, the Malwa were often exasperated by the Yetai. But for all their obvious displeasure at the Yetai behavior, the Kshatriyas made no attempt to stop the gambling. No more would a man try to stop his pet hyena from gnawing on a bone. Usanas moved back a little farther into the alley, hiding against the overhanging branches of a large bush.
He was not worried about being spotted. The Malwad dynasty also didn't waste money clearing wild shrubbery from the alleys of their capital. Why should they? They did not travel through alleys. He hefted one of his javelins, gauging the throw. He had brought two of the weapons along with his great stabbing spear. The blades of all three had been blackened with soot. Again, Usanas hefted the javelin. Yes, the range was good. If it proved necessary, he would use the javelins to deal with the Kshatriyas on the barge. The stabbing spear he would save for the Yetai. He didn't even think about the two grenades which Menander had given him. To Usanas, the grenades were simply signaling devices. They were far too impersonal for Yetai. Elsewhere, a mile to the southwest, Menander was regretting the absence of his stolen grenades. As he watched the mass of Malwa common soldiers milling around the campfires where they were cooking their evening meal, he thought that a couple of well-placed grenades would do wonders. But he said nothing. The grenades had been the only things they had which could give the signal, if the signal proved necessary. It had been Menander himself who had made the suggestion. And besides, the young cataphract didn't want to hear another lecture from Valentinian on the virtues of cold steel. Menander turned his head and looked to his left. Valentinian was crouched behind a tree trunk not 4 feet away. The veteran met his gaze but said nothing. Menander looked to his right. He couldn't see Anastasius, but he knew the cataphract was there, hidden a little further down the line of trees which bordered the Malwa army camp. Azana and Wasi would be hiding near him, still farther down the line. Prince Aeon would be somewhere near them. Garmat was hidden in the trees also, but the advisor was further back. Despite his protests, the old brigand had been assigned the duty of holding the horses. He and Cadphises, the Kushan soldier who would serve as their guide if they had to make an escape. Somebody had to do it, after all. There were 20 of those horses, all of them high-spirited and tense. Garmat was the best horseman among them, Mezana had pointed out forcefully, and so the duty naturally fell to him. No one had mentioned the advisor's age, of course, but Garmat's glare had shown plainly what he thought of the arrangement. Menander didn't even try to spot Kujalo and the three Kushan soldiers with him. They would also by now have found their own hiding place in the trees. But that hiding place would be on the opposite side of the little army base. Gloomily, Menander studied the Malwa soldiers clustering around their campfires. 800 of them, he estimated. Piss-poor soldiers, true, but they were still the enemy, and there were still 800 of them. Mother of God, I hope this won't be more than an exercise. A sleepless night in the woods at worst. False alarm. Tomorrow Belisarius is back, no problem. Everybody has a big laugh on the subject of twitchy nerves. Soon enough we amble out of India in comfort and ease, back to Rome with nary a drop of spilled blood. To his left, watching Menander in the flickering light cast by the campfires, Valentinian saw the little interplay of emotions on the young cataphract's face. The veteran grinned. Welcome to the club, lad. It's the first law of the veteran. Fuck exciting adventures. A mile to the east, to the relief of some 15 Kushan soldiers, Badaji Holkar pronounced himself satisfied with the howdahs. About time, grumbled Kanishka. Holkar stared him down. And quite an effective stare it was, too. Just what you might expect from a Malwa grandee, which was exactly what Holkar looked like in his new finery. The very essence of a grandee. Not Anvia Prapta Sachevya, to be sure. No member of that most exclusive dynastic caste would have personally overseen the loading of his own elephants. But the Malwa Empire had a multitude of grandees, especially in Kaushambi. The capital was full of officials, noblemen, bureaucrats, potentates of every stripe and variety. Holkar turned away and strode over to the stable-keeper. That man, blessed with the same haughty stare, abased himself in a most gratifying manner. His three sons, standing just behind, copied their father faithfully. Watching him fawn, Holkar felt enormous relief. He'd been afraid he would have to murder them. And if he had been forced to order the Kushans to kill the men of the family, there would have been no choice but to slaughter the other members of the stable-keeper's household. A wife, a daughter, two daughters-in-law, and three servants. Holkar would have done it if necessary, but the deed would have cut to his soul. The stable-keeper was no Malwa enemy, just a man feeding his family by caring for the horses and elephants of those richer than he. But there was no need. It was obvious that the disguise had passed muster perfectly. True, it was odd for such a grandee to make his departure at night rather than in daytime, but Hooker had explained the matter satisfactorily. Urgent news, his wife's father on his deathbed. Fool woman, he grumbled. She insists on an immediate departure in the middle of the night, and then takes hours to prepare herself. The stablekeeper, daringly, essayed a moment of shared camaraderie. What can you do, Lord? Women are impossible. For a moment, Holker glared at the man's presumption, but after seeing the stablekeeper cringe properly, he relented. He had intimidated the man enough, he thought. A bit of kindness now would seal the disguise. I am most satisfied with you, stablekeeper, he announced pompously. The elephants have been well cared for, and the howlers which you constructed are quite to my satisfaction. The stablekeeper bowed and scraped effusively, but Hooker was amused to see that the man's eyes never left off from watching Hooker's hand. And when the stablekeeper saw that hand dip into the very large purse suspended from Hooker's waist, his eyes positively gleamed. As I promised you, there would be a bonus for good work. Hooker, watching the man's face as he deposited a small pile of coins in the stablekeeper's outstretched hand, decided he had gauged the bonus correctly. But just to be sure, Hooker decided to unbend a bit. Yes, I am very satisfied. Might I make a request? Since my wife appears to be delayed, would you be so good as to feed my men? I have mentioned to them from my previous visits how excellent a cook your wife is. He dipped his hand into the purse again. I will pay, of course. Within seconds, the stablekeeper's household was flurrying into action. Watching the perfect unfolding of their plan, the scribe Dadaji Holker smiled. Warriors, he knew, were prone to dark misgivings about any and all plans. Holker didn't sneer at those misgivings. He'd been a warrior himself in his youth, but he concluded, as he had years before, that soldiers were a gloomy lot. One soldier, at that very moment, was not gloomy at all. He had come to India for a number of reasons, and with several goals in mind. Most of those goals he had already achieved. He had used the voyage to forge an alliance between Rome and Ethiopia. He had freed the Empress of Andhra from captivity, and thus laid the basis for another alliance with Shi and Raghunath Rao. He had even, to his delight, managed to use Malwa bribes to fund the future Deccan Rebellion. He had been able to learn much concerning the new Malwa gunpowder weapons, knowledge which, combined with Aid's help, would make possible the creation of a new Roman army capable of dealing with the Malwa juggernaut. Mainly, however, Belisarius had come to India in order to know his enemy. He was a general, and he considered good intelligence to be the most useful of all military assets. Here, too, he had accomplished much. He had seen the Malwa army in action, as well as their Yetai, Rajput, and Kushan auxiliaries. He'd been able to study the workings of Malwa society at close hand. He had even been able, to some extent, to meet and gauge the emperor himself and many of his top military and civilian advisers. But the one thing he had not accomplished was to meet his ultimate enemy, Link, the being, creature, who was in some way the origin of the newly arisen menace threatening Rome, and, he thought, all of mankind. Link. He wasn't sure yet. But following Nanda Lal through the plushness of the royal barge, he thought he was on the verge of achieving that goal also. Aid certainly thought he was. Yes, Link is here. I am certain of it. Belisarius remembered the glimpses Aid had given him once before of the strange thinking machines called computers. Huge things, some of them. Rows and rows of steel cabinets. Others no bigger than a small chest. Metal and glass glowing as if by magic. Not those. The new gods have driven cybernetics far beyond such primitive devices. The word cybernetics was meaningless to Belisarius. Other words which followed were equally so. Nanotechnology. Microminiaturization. Cybernetic organisms. They were nearing the end of the long corridor which extended down the side of the barge. Ahead of him, Belisarius saw Nanda Lal step across a raised threshold into what appeared to be a large room. We're almost there, he said to Aid. He sensed the agitation of the facets. Aid's next thought was curt. Link will be a cyborg, a cybernetic organism. It will look like a human, but will not be. There will be no soul behind the eyes. Then, with the cool shivering which was as close as crystalline consciousness could come to fear, if I am present in your mind, it may discover me. In the chaos at the pavilion, when I asked you to look into the Emperor's eyes, I was certain I could disguise myself. Here, I am not certain. The facets can hide, but Abe may not be able to. Belisarius was at the threshold himself. He paused, as if gauging the height of the step necessary to cross the small barrier. Dissolve yourself, then, until you can safely reappear. You are our greatest asset. We must keep knowledge of you hidden from the enemy. If Aid dissolves, the facet will not be able to help. This moment is very dangerous for you. Belisarius strode across the threshold. My name is Belisarius. I am your general. Do as I command. If there was any hesitation in Aid's reply, no human could have measured it. Yes, great one. The salon into which Belisarius stepped was, in its own way, as phantasmagorical as the pavilion which Emperor Skandagupta had erected on a battlefield. Such incredible luxury aboard a barge verged on the ludicrous. The room was large, especially for a boat, but could not be described as huge. It was perhaps 30 feet wide. Belisarius, quickly estimating the width of the barge itself, realized that the side walls of the salon were the actual hull of the barge. The planking of the hull here on the interior was almost completely covered, deck to ceiling, with exquisite silk tapestries. Most of the tapestries depicted scenes which were obviously mythological. Based on various tales which Dadaji had told him, he thought that one of the tapestries might be a depiction of Arjuna riding with Krishna at the Battle of Kurukshetra, but he wasn't sure, and he didn't waste time examining the tapestries carefully. He was much more interested in the few areas of the walls which were not covered with tapestries. The salon was some 40 feet in length. At three places along each wall, separated by a distance of approximately 10 feet, were 3-foot-square bamboo frames supporting silk mesh. The silk was dyed in Malwa red and gold, but not otherwise decorated. Belisarius could not see through the mesh squares, but from their slight billowing, he knew that they were the coverings for windows designed to let air into the salon. After a moment's glance at the windows, he looked away. Ahead of him, at the far end of the salon, two women were seated on a dais which was elevated perhaps a foot above the level of the thickly carpeted deck. The chairs in which they sat could not be called thrones. They were not quite big enough. That aside, however, they were chairs which any emperor would be proud to call his own. The chairs were made of nothing but carved ivory, covered with a minimum of cushioning. Neither gold nor gems adorned those chairs. Such baubles would have simply degraded the intricate and marvelous carvings which embellished every square inch of their surface. Both women were shrouded in rich saris, and both women's faces were obscured by veils. From a distance, Belisarius could discern little about them. But he thought, from the slight subtleties of their posture, that the one on his right was much older than the other. Directly in front of the dais, kneeling, was a line of 6 men. Eunuchs, Belisarius suspected, from what he had learned of Malwa customs with high-born women. The men were all wearing baggy trousers tied off at the ankles. They were barefoot and bare-chested. Racially, the men were of a type unfamiliar to Belisarius. Oriental, clearly, but quite unlike any of the Asiatic peoples with which Belisarius was familiar. Their skin tone was yellowish, quite unlike the brown hues of the various Indian peoples. And while Belisarius had often seen that yellowish color on the skins of steppe nomads, Yetai and especially Kushans were often that tint, or close to it, these men had none of the lean, hard-featured characteristics of Asians from the steppes. Like Kushans, though not Yetai, who were often called white Huns, these men also had a slanted look to their eyes. If anything, their epicanthic folds were even more pronounced. But their features were soft-looking, without a trace of steppe starkness. And their faces were so round as to be almost moon-shaped. Their most striking characteristic, however, was sheer size. All of them were enormous. Belisarius estimated their height at well over 6 feet, closer to 7, and he thought that none of them weighed less than 300 pounds. Some of that size was fat, true, All six of the men had bellies which bulged forward noticeably. But Belisarius did not fail to note their huge arms and their great sloping shoulders. The muscles there, coiled beneath the fat, were like so many pythons. Nor, of course, did the general miss the bared tulwars which each man held across his knees. Those tulwars were the biggest swords Belisarius had ever seen in his life. None but giants such as these could have possibly wielded them. Nanda Lal, standing a few feet ahead of him, bowed deeply to the two women. He then turned to Belisarius, and with an apologetic grimace, whispered,
"I'm afraid we must search you for weapons, General. As I told you, Great Lady Holy is extremely sensitive concerning her personal safety."
Belisarius stiffened. Nanda Lal's demand was discourteous in the extreme. As the spymaster well knew, Belisarius was already unarmed, had been for days. As a matter of course, he did not carry weapons with him in the presence of Mawat royalty. He left his arms behind in the mansion that morning, as he did every day he went to the Grand Palace. The act had come naturally to him. His own Emperor Justinian would have been apoplectic if anyone other than his bodyguards carried weapons into the imperial presence. But he saw no point in protest. If, as Aide suspected, he was truly in the presence of Link, the Mawa paranoia was understandable. "Of course," he said. He spread his arms, inviting Nanda Lal to search his person. Then, hearing a slight cough behind him, turned around. Four men were standing there. Belisarius had not heard a whisper of their coming. Despite the thick carpeting, he was impressed. Quickly, he gauged them. The men were clearly of the same race as the giant eunuchs, but, unlike them, were of average size. Nor were any of them bearing those huge tulwars. Instead, each of the four men was armed with nothing Belisarius could see beyond long knives scabbarded to their waists. Their size did not mislead the general. Belisarius thought they were probably twice as dangerous as the giant eunuchs, and he was certain, from the silent manner of their arrival, even more than their sure-footed stance, that all four were expert assassins. Still, with his arms raised, he allowed the foremost of those men to search him. The assassin's search was quick and expert. When the man was finished, he stepped back and said a few phrases in a language Belisarius did not know. Nanda Lal frowned. "He says you are carrying a small knife in that pouch on your belt." Startled, Belisarius looked down at the pouch in question. He began to reach for it, but froze when he sensed the sudden stillness in the four assassins watching him. Belisarius turned his head toward Nanda Lal. "I did not even think of it, Nanda Lal. It isn't a weapon. It's simply a little knife I carry with me to sharpen my inkwells." With a wry smile, "I imagine I could kill a chicken with it after a desperate struggle." He shrugged. "You're quite welcome to take the thing if it makes you nervous." Nanda Lal stared at him for a moment, then, without taking his eyes from the general, asked the assassin a question in that same unknown tongue. The assassin spoke a few phrases. Nanda Lal smiled. "Never mind, General. Great Lady Holy's chief bodyguard confirms your depiction of the, device." Now the image of cordiality, Nanda Lal took Belisarius by the arm and began leading him toward the women at the far end of the salon. The spymaster leaned over and whispered, "The bodyguard says the chicken would win." Belisarius smiled crookedly. "He underestimates my prowess, but I'm quite certain I would carry the scars to my grave." 10 feet from the line of kneeling eunuchs, Nanda Lal brought himself and Belisarius to a halt. Nanda Lal, Belisarius, following the spymaster's example, bowed deeply, but did not prostrate himself. Two servants appeared from a small door in the corner of the room behind the seated women. The servants carried cushions, which they set on the floor just in front of Belisarius and Nanda Lal. That done, each man stepped away. They did not leave, however, but remained standing, one on either side. As he squatted down on his cushion, Belisarius gave them both a quick, searching, sidelong scrutiny.
"Servants, I think. Nothing more."
A feminine voice drew his attention forward. The voice had the timbre of a young woman, and it came, just as he had surmised, from the woman seated to his left.
"We are very pleased to meet you at last, General Belisarius. We've heard so much about you." Belisarius could discern nothing of the woman's face because of her veil, but he did not miss the sharp intelligence in that voice lurking beneath the platitudes, nor the fact that the Greek in which it spoke was perfect, without a trace of an accent. He nodded his head in acknowledgement, but said nothing. The young woman continued.
My name is Sati. I have the honor of being one of Empress Gandagupta's daughters.
A slight gesture of the hand of the woman seated next to her,
is the great Lady Holly, the Emperor's aunt, as I imagine you have already been told.
The great Lady Holly's head bobbed minutely. Beyond that, the woman was as still as a statue. The veil completely disguised her face also. Again, Belisarius nodded.
My aunt asked to meet you because she has heard that you desire to give your allegiance to the destiny of Malwa, and she has heard that you have proposed the most ingenious plan to further our great cause.
Belisarius decided that this last remark required a reply.
I thank you and her for your kind words. I would not go so far as to describe my plan as ingenious, though it is, I think, shrewd.
The Roman Emperor Justinian is planning to invade the Western Mediterranean anyway. I simply intend to encourage him in the endeavor. In that manner, without drawing suspicion upon myself, I can keep Rome's armies from interfering with your coming conquest of Persia. He stopped, hoping that would be enough, but the Lady Sati pressed him further.
Are you not concerned that the reunification of the Roman Empire will pose a long-term danger to Malwa?
Belisarius shook his head very firmly.
No, Lady Sati. Justinian's project is sheer folly.
You are saying that the Eastern Roman Empire cannot reconquer the West?
There was a lurking danger in that question, Belisarius sensed, though he couldn't tell exactly where it lay. After a slight hesitation, he decided that truth was the best option.
I didn't say that. In my opinion, the conquest is possible. In fact,
here another pause, but this one for calculated effect.
If you will allow me the immodesty, I'm convinced that it can be done, so long as Justinian gives me the command of the enterprise. But it will be a fruitless victory.
Why so?
He shrugged.
We can reconquer the West, but not easily. The wars will be long and difficult. At the end, Justinian will rule over a war-ravaged West, which he will try to administer from a bankrupted East. Rome will be larger in size and much smaller in strength.
Ah.
That was all Lady Sati said, but Belisarius instantly knew that he had passed some kind of test. The knowledge brought a slight relief to the tension which tightened his neck. But a moment later, the tension returned in full force. For the first time, Great Lady Holly spoke.
Come closer, young man. My eyes are old and poor. I wish to see your face better.
Her Greek was also perfect and unaccented.
Belisarius did not hesitate, not at least any longer than necessary to gauge the proper distance to maintain.
He arose from his cross-legged position on the cushion, he too had learned the lotus, and took two steps forward. Just before the line of tulwars, he knelt on one knee, bringing his eyes approximately level to those of the old woman seated a few feet away. The great Lady Holly leaned forward. A hand, veined with age, reached up and lifted her veil. Dark eyes gazed directly into the brown eyes of Belisarius. Empty eyes. Dark, not from color, but from the absence of anything within.
Is it true that you plan to betray Rome?
There was something strange about those words, he sensed dimly. An odd, penetrating quality to their tone. He could feel the words racing down pathways in his body. Nerves, arteries, veins, muscle tissue, ligaments.
Do you plan to betray Rome?
He was giving himself away, he realized. Dimly, vaguely, at a distance. The intelligence behind those words was inhuman. It was reading his minute, involuntary reactions in a way no human could. No man alive could lie well enough to fool that thing. But it was the eyes, not the voice, which held him paralyzed. Not from fear, but horror. He knew now the true nature of hell. It wasn't fire and damnation.
It was simply empty. Nothing.
As so often before in his life, it was Valentinian who saved him. Valentinian and Anastasius and Morris and countless other such veterans. Coarse men, crude men, lewd men, rude men, brutal men often, even cruel men on occasion. But always men, never empty and never nothing. General Belisarius smiled his crooked smile and said quite pleasantly, "Fuck Mawa." Then, still kneeling, drove his right boot heel straight back into the face of Nanda Lal. He was a powerful man, and it was a boot heel which had trampled battlefields underfoot. It flattened the spymaster and obliterated his nose.